Hello, everyone. It's Scott Tips again. It's Wednesday. It's the 25th of July. And I'm here in Paris, basically. Lovely weather. No chemtrail skies. So to my mind, that's always lovely weather. And it's still daylight, of course, being this high up in the latitude, it'll stay light, of course, a long time, as will it in Dublin and Edinburgh and London and other places like that. I remember once calculating when I was in the Monaco area that Monaco was on the same latitude as Medford, Oregon, and that was Monaco. Rome was on the same latitude as New York City. So you can imagine where we are now. Paris is 900 kilometers further north than even Nice and Monaco. So it's even further up. And during the summer, we'll have really, of course, as you know, late daylight. Well, what I wanted to talk about tonight, and I don't have a guest, is basically about what's dominated the news for a long time, ever since it happened, which is the Colorado maniac shooter, James Holmes. And I guess there's a saying I want to give you first, which is, which I posted just today as well. I came across it from an organization called the Future of Freedom Foundation, based in Arlington, Virginia, which is actually a very good organization. Their website is www.fff, that's three Fs, .org. And it was a quote from a guy named Joseph Sobran, whom you may have heard of. And it basically goes, if you want government to intervene domestically, you're a liberal. If you want government to intervene overseas, you're a conservative. If you want government to intervene everywhere, then you're a moderate. If you don't want government to intervene anywhere, then you're an extremist. And so I guess that makes me an extremist because I don't believe government should intervene anywhere. And that sort of gets to the basic philosophy of what we're going to talk about tonight, sort of to set the philosophical grounding is if you believe, as I do, that in freedom, then where does that come from? That comes from the right to one's own person. That is the right to live your life as you wish, without anyone else telling you what to do, so long as you respect the same equal right in others. So that means a right to one's own person. That means no slavery, no coercive force exerted on you, except to restrain you from exerting coercive force on others. But, you know, that's meaningless if you don't have the right to support yourself. So from that comes, at least to many people's minds, the right to gather property to support oneself. But just as important as that, it also means the right to defend oneself too. And, you know, in the U.S. Constitution, which I studied in law school, but of course had studied much well before then, the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, of course, governs the right to free speech. The Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gives the individual right to citizens, to residents in the United States to carry firearms. Actually, it gives them the right to more than just firearms. And a lot of people don't like this, especially Europeans and Asians who don't quite understand this American mentality. And even a lot of Canadians who, especially those who are descended from the ones who lost in the Revolutionary War and fled up to Canada so they could still worship the King of England. In any event, this is really a provision that's not meant, like some people think, to guarantee the right to go hunting. It's not about the right to shoot at clay pigeons or round circles. No, the Second Amendment was intended by the founding fathers of the United States to be a doomsday provision. You know, if all other guaranteed rights fail, you know, right to free elections, right to free speech, right to worship the religion of one's choice or not to if one has no religion, the right to be free of unfair and unlawful imprisonment. You know, all these different rights, the right to, well, subsumed within that is the right to be free from a too high a bail, and certainly the right to cruel and unusual punishment. But if all of those were to fail, then what is left for the citizen but to fall back on their right of self-defense, to actually overturn their oppressive government and replace it with a less oppressive government? And indeed, I think a lot of American citizens today would give their eye teeth to be able to live in the 1770s under the, and I'll put quote marks around it, the oppressive regime of King George III, which was actually extremely light-handed by comparison to the rule that one sees from Washington, D.C. these days. So that's really what it's about. It's about the right to defend yourself against a tyrannical regime. And in fact, in the Cold War days, and I don't know if I mentioned this before, but the Soviet Union, the central command of the Soviet Union Armed Forces would, of course, routinely do war games. They would do these war games, and they would plot how an invasion or attack against Eastern and Western Europe would go, mainly Western Europe, of course, Central Western, an attack against China, an attack against the United States, the rest of North America. And their war games kept faltering at the two-week period, maximum two-month period, because they realized that everyone in the U.S. was so heavily armed that all of their divisions would have been shot dead by the two-month mark. So they realized that an invasion of the West Coast of the U.S. wouldn't succeed. And even as we all know, Yamamoto, the engineer, the creator of the Pearl Harbor attack, he himself said that because there would be a rifle behind every blade of grass for the Japanese to invade the United States. So there is a method to this madness. And even though a lot of people don't see this, that is actually the reason behind it. So what do we have? We have this maniac named James Holmes, who goes into a movie theater, which paradoxically is called the Century 16 movie theater. What is Century 16? Well, century is 100 from Latin, so 100. 16, we know that means 16 rooms or viewing rooms at the theater, but you add those together, you get 116. You look at it in a mirror backwards and maybe upside down, you get 9/11. I don't know. Is there any significance to that? 9/11, 116? I don't know. You be the judge. I didn't think that up. Someone else did. And basically, that is may give us a clue right there. So what do we have with this crazy 24-year-old Jimmy Holmes, who is actually very brilliant? He had presented a paper on neurological disorders. He's a PhD candidate, University of Colorado in Denver. He did, interestingly enough, a summer internship at the Salk Institute, which was involved in research to create peak soldiers for the battlefield. And so this was not a dumb guy. This was a guy who was actually very, very smart. They won't release the records of his time at the medical school, but someday that will be released. Now, this is not meant to be a definitive biography of this alleged shooter, but what we do know is that he killed at least 12 people at the Aurora Theater when he opened fire in there. And we also know that he probably had help. And how do we know this? Well, we know this because he was unemployed. He was a student. He wasn't rich. And yet he had $20,000 worth of equipment, including a bulletproof vest, including the latest arms and ammunition, a lot of ammunition. I forget how many rounds of ammunition he had, but just a lot. the tear gas canisters, all of that. And they calculated how much that all cost. And it was about 20 grand. So where did you get that from? And a lot of it was high tech stuff. Of course, they're trying to claim, the mainstream media, that he got it through mail order and all of that. But the timing of all of this is so strange. And it's not the first time that we've seen this. One other curious thing about Mr. Holmes's background is that his father, Dr. Robert Holmes, worked with a company called HFCM Software that did work for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. This was research that Dr. Holmes was involved in. It's called Cortronic Neural Networking. It's all about man-machine interface. And there are a lot of links with MKUltra, you know, MKUltra, like in the Bourne movies, Jason Bourne. Treadstone, that's depicted in those movies, is a lot like MKUltra. There are a lot of famous people who are involved with MKUltra, as you know, this mind control project. J.D. Salinger, who wrote Catcher in the Rye. Timothy Leary, the LSD guy. Ted Kaczynski, you remember him, the Unabomber. All of them were involved in the MKUltra project in some shape, form, or fashion. And an interesting thing that you may not know is that when these crazy people, and I'm not talking about Timothy Leary, whom I have met, by the way, egotistical maniac that he is, could only talk about himself the whole time. The other two, I never met. Fortunately, Ted Kaczynski, I never met, but or J.D. Salinger. But the other people who actually went out and committed crimes, they had a lot in common. They usually didn't have a lot of books, but if you looked in on their bookshelf, the one book that they had in common was Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. Catcher in the Rye. And there's some who say The Dark Knight Rises, the Batman film that was playing at the time that Jimmy Holmes opened up on the crowd, has pretty much the same plot line. But I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe someone in the audience can let me know, someone on the chat line. And other people have looked at it. Yes, thank you. 6,000 rounds. Boy, that's an incredible number. Rounds of ammunition are not cheap. And they are just not cheap. So I can tell you from experience, because my background was growing up in Texas, especially South Texas. Now I can talk like a Texan if I have to, but what I do want to say is that growing up in Texas had its benefits and also had its drawbacks. But one of the benefits is we all grew up with guns. I had one since I was 10 years old. The girls had guns just as much as the boys, and no one went around shooting people. It just didn't really happen. I mean, there were accidents, of course, things like that, and maybe once in a blue moon, someone might go crazy, but really, honestly, I can't remember a single time during all of that time that I was growing up of even hearing of an accidental shooting, let alone a deliberate one. And that's with everyone and their, you know, dog armed to the teeth with guns. It's only been more recently that you hear about all of this. I mean, so is MKUltra involved? Is it drugs? I mean, look at James's reaction. You all probably saw on television or on the internet his reaction after the shooting. It's no different than Sirhan Sirhan, who allegedly shot Robert F. Kennedy, or Jack Ruby, who shot Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, or David Chapman, who shot John Lennon, or Arthur Brimmer, who shot the U.S. presidential candidate George Wallace. Or Squeaky Fromm, who shot at Gerald Ford, or John Hinckley, even, who shot at Ronald Reagan. They all had the same sort of blank expression afterwards when they were picked up. And what does that tell you? I mean, there's something going on. No attempt to escape. In many cases, they just went limp are calmly waited nearby for the arrest. Even Holmes, he immediately fessed up that his apartment was booby-trapped. So, you know, these are people who are not in their right mind. And many of them actually have no recollection of the event or have a single line of political thought on what they did or what to repeat. So it wasn't politically motivated, at least not by them. And then, you know, whenever they're questioned at the critical moment, they'll just change the subject when they answer the question or not answer the question, as the case may be. So, you know, these are all known methods of disassociation, symptomatic of programmed sort of Manchurian type candidates who are incapable of confessing the truth, as really genuinely they aren't even aware of what they've done. And in this case, we know Holmes, he simply waited in his car and put up no resistance whatsoever. What we don't know is if he told the police anything at all other than that his apartment is booby-trapped. But we must presume that he probably didn't, or it would have been in the news. But again, we don't really know. Also, another interesting thing is Holmes drove a car to the cinema that had Tennessee plates. He was in Colorado. As you know, in the United States, each individual state, not the federal government, issues automobile license plates. So here he's driving with Tennessee plates. What's the connection? Is there anything? Maybe nothing. You know, rental cars go across state lines, and it may have just been a rental car and nothing important. But on the other hand, it is or could be something. So let me see. This is just looking to see at the chat line if there are any questions. Yeah, Doug Dodgers mentions, didn't his car have Tennessee plates? And yes, I did say that. And here we are looking at a situation where, let's assume it's not MK Ultra, then could it be drugs? You know, you just consider about all the shootings in the past. I mean, just this year, earlier this year, there was a 16-year-old named Jeff Weiss who went into a school on an Indian reservation, and he blew away 10 of his friends. And guess what? He was taking the antidepressant Prozac. And you go back. You can go back as far as you want, just about, as long as they were giving out Prozac and Ritalin and Xanax and Ambien. In DeKalb, Illinois, February 14th, 2008, 27-year-old Stephen Kamerzak shot and killed 5 people, wounded 16 others before killing himself at the Northern Illinois University auditorium there. And according to his girlfriend, he had been taking Prozac, Xanax, and Ambien. And toxicology results showed, a report showed, that he still had trace amounts of Xanax in his system when he was killed. Omaha, Nebraska, December 5th, 2007, 19-year-old Robert Hopkins killed 8 people, wounded 5 before committing suicide. And he was on antidepressants. Autopsy results confirmed he was under the influence of Valium. In Finland, November 7th, 2007, 18-year-old Finnish gunman Pekka Erik Ovinen had been taking antidepressants before he killed 8 people and wounded a dozen more at a high school in southern Finland. Then he committed suicide. Cleveland, Ohio, October 10th, 2007, 14-year-old Asa Kuhn stormed through a school with a gun in each hand, shooting and wounding 4 before taking his own life. Court records themselves show that Kuhn had been placed on the antidepressant drug trazodone. Blacksburg, Virginia, the famous Virginia Tech massacre, April 16th of 2007. 23-year-old Sung Hui Cho shot to death 32 students and faculty at Virginia Tech and then killed himself. He had been receiving mental health treatment and he had been on drugs as well. Red Lake, Minnesota, March 2005, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss on Prozac shot and killed his grandparents, then went to a school on the Red Lake Indian Reservation where he shot dead 7 students and a teacher and wounded 7 others before killing himself. Again, on Prozac. Greenbush, New York, February 2004, 16-year-old John Romano strolled into his own high school in East Greenbush and opened fire with a shotgun. One person was fortunately just wounded, and Romano had been taking medication for depression. El Cajon, California, March 22, 2001, 18-year-old Jason Hoffman, He was on antidepressants Celexa and Effexor. He opened fire on his classmates, wounding three students and two teachers at Granite Hills High School. I mean, this list goes on. I have a huge list here. I mean, I could spend the rest of our time just going through it, but I think I make the point. I mean, we have, oh, let's go to the Columbine shootings because Michael Moore made that real famous. Not that it wasn't already famous, but the Columbine shootings in April, on April 20th, 1999, 18-year-old Eric Harris and his accomplice, Dylan Klebold, killed 12 students and a teacher and wounded 26 others before they killed themselves. Harris was on the antidepressant Luvox. Klebold's medical records remained sealed, but I bet you dollars to donuts that he was on drugs as well. I mean, it just goes on. So, you know, given the fact that these shooters were on psychiatric drugs, given the fact that there are no fewer than 22 international drug regulatory agencies warning that all of these drugs that I mentioned by name can cause violence, mania, psychosis, suicide, and even homicide, given the fact that a major study was just released confirming these drugs put people at greater risk of becoming violent, you know, why are they actually blaming guns? They should be blaming the drugs. The drugs are what are causing this. You know, we didn't have these drugs when I was growing up, so we didn't have kids going around shooting people up in schools. And the fact of the matter is that this is something that is being used, being parlayed into a situation where they're trying another false flag event to manipulate the public, in this case, the American public, to enacting the UN Small Arms Gun Treaty to take away the Second Amendment rights of Americans to defend themselves against politicians and government bad doers. And that is really what it's all about, where you even have stupid Mexico calling for heavy gun control laws in the U.S., right? That's a case of the pot calling the kettle black. Mexico, which is rampant with guns and doesn't even have control over its own country, that government has some nerve telling the U.S. what to do. It needs to get its own house in order. And so what we have are a lot of people who think, oh, we'll take care of the symptoms. We'll just take the guns out of the hands of the law-abiding people. And, of course, who's going to be left with the guns? Well, it's going to be the criminals, because if they don't care about shooting someone up, you think they're going to care about some gun control law? No, they aren't. I mean, look at Great Britain. Great Britain has become Little Britain because it's devolved into this idiotic regime. This is my, sorry, everyone, anti-loss of British freedom rant, because it used to be, you know, man's home was his castle. I mean, this is the country that sort of spread to the rest of the world the sanctity of private property rights. This is the one where every Englishman was armed. I mean, this was the country where they trained footmen in using longbows and arrows that, you know, stopped the French armies dead for decades. And so here we have a situation now where an honest homeowner defending himself or herself against an armed intruder shoots and wounds someone, or God forbid, actually kills them. But you have that wounded person going out and then being able to sue and get a court award, against the innocent homeowner for having wounded him, and getting a huge judgment in the hundreds of thousands of pounds. I mean, where is justice from that kind of thing? People aren't safe in their own homes. Yeah, you can pick up a phone and you can call an English bobby and maybe he'll be there in 30 minutes. You know, the old joke where the person calls up and says, I think I have some intruder in my shed. How quickly can the police be there? Well, I'm sorry, we don't have anyone in the neighborhood, so it might be about 30 minutes. So the person hangs up the phone, the concerned homeowner, picks up the phone again, calls the emergency number, says, I just shot two armed intruders in my shed, and I think you better come. Well, in 3 minutes, the police are there, maybe a minute and a half. The police are there. I mean, with SWAT team, everything, you know, sirens, lights flashing, they're there. 3 minutes haven't passed. They go up to him. Where are the dead bodies? Oh, there aren't any. You mean you lied to the police? Yes, but you lied to me. You said there's no one in the neighborhood and it'd take 30 minutes to get here. So that is the state of affairs in almost all countries. People need to be able to defend themselves. And one of the things I've never understood is the fact that women are the biggest opponents of guns, and yet women are the ones who could benefit most from it. I mean, what would you rather be? A 90-pound woman up against two without any arms, up against two 220-pound bruisers who are trying to break into your house? Or would you rather have a handgun that you could at least try to scare them away? Let me give you a couple of examples. One of the examples is a woman, and this is recent. This was in South Carolina. Now, here's the news report. When burglars invaded the home of Ruby Hodge, 89 years old, they got a lot more than they bargained for. Hodge was in her bedroom just after 8 a.m. Monday morning when she heard a knock at her back door. Before she could get to the door, the burglars had forced their way inside. The great-grandmother came face to face with two men dressed in black down her hallway. I reached and I got my pistol and I met them right outside of my bedroom. Right inside of my bedroom door, two black men passed, and they were two medium black men, and they were dressed in black. And when they saw me standing in there with my pistol, they left and ran. So this is from just 2 days ago, July 23rd, 89 years old. Now, what do you think would have happened if she hadn't been armed? I'll give you another example. The former president of National Health Federation, Maureen Solomon, was in her very expensive home in a very expensive neighborhood south of San Francisco one night when two men came to her door. Well, because she wasn't expecting anyone, she very smartly went to the door with her, you know, portable phone in her hand and a gun in the other and opened the door. Actually, there were three men. And they told her to get out of the way. They were coming in to rob her. And she said, no, you aren't. I've got the police on one line and I have a gun in the other. And one of the men just sort of laughed. I mean, Maureen told me this story directly, so I'm telling it from her lips to my ears to your ears. So Maureen said to them, well, that may be true. You may be able to overwhelm me, but I'll get at least one or two of you before that happens. And who wants to be first? And with that, they turned and went away. Well, at that time, she was probably about 65 years old, maybe 60 years old. And this is an example of what I call the great equalizer. You can take a 90-pound woman, and Maureen was 5'1" tall, probably weighed soaking wet 90 pounds, and she stood off three men because she had a gun. So here's the great equalizer. So there need to be more women who take note of this and don't oppose having guns properly owned and the like. And let's see what happens to the crime rates here, because what I've seen is that let's go, for example, to comparative gun control and murder rates. So the question was asked, do countries with strong gun control laws have lower murder rates? That's a good question, actually. But the answer is only if you cherry pick the data. Britain is a country with stronger gun control laws than the U.S. and lower murder rates. That's true. But Mexico, Russia, and Brazil are also countries with stronger gun control laws than the United States, and their murder rates are much higher than the U.S.'s. So again, if you cherry pick your data, you can come up with the answer you want to. Israel and Switzerland have even higher rates of gun ownership than the United States, and yet their murder rates are much lower than those of the American rates. Even the British example really doesn't stand up very well under scrutiny, because the murder rate in New York City has always been several times that in London for more than two centuries. And for most of that time, neither place had strong gun control laws. Then New York had strong gun control laws for years before London did, but New York still had several times the murder rate of London. So, you know, that's not, gun control laws are not an answer either. It was in the later decades of the 20th century that the British government actually clamped down, you know, with severe gun control laws, disarming virtually, you know, the entire citizenry, certainly the law-abiding population. But gun crimes, including murder, rose as the public was disarmed. You'll actually see, if you look at the murder rate, that gun crimes actually went on the increase in Great Britain, not on the decrease. And meanwhile, again, compare it with the U.S., the murder rates in the U.S. declined during these same years when murder rates in Britain were rising, which were also years when Americans were buying millions more in guns each and every year. So, you know, you do the math, you do the thinking, and someone commented the English are just too apathetic to start a fight with anyone. And, you know, I'm sorry to say that may be true, except at football games when you have the hooligans get drunk and then maybe they want to pick a fight then. So anyway, so there's that. I'm not saying there isn't some fight there, but it is, again, something that gives you cause for control, for thought, food for thought. So look at the situation. Here we have a very opportunistic serial killing, or mass murder, really, not serial, by this guy who has no history of any activity, who has this weird look to him when he's arrested, has this really spooky background, and his father used to work on the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or for them, for a company that worked for them. And it all has the earmarks of a false flag operation. And then what do these people do, of course, the mass media? What do they do? Well, look at ABC News, the American Broadcasting Company in the U.S. You know, they took the fact that the man was arrested for the shooting and his name was James Holmes. So what did they do? They broadcast to the world the fact that, oh, there's a James Holmes who's a member of the Tea Party in Colorado. Of course, the fact has since come out that these are two different men, one in his 20s and the other in his 50s. But of course, corrections never catch up with irresponsible news broadcasts. The James Holmes who belongs to the Tea Party has been deluged with phone calls, and I hope he sues ABC News for every dime they have. So similar things have happened before. This is not the first time that we've seen this, where the mainstream media tries to create a link between conservatives and violence, or between libertarians and violence. Years ago with the Oklahoma City bombing, it was blamed on Rush Limbaugh. Now, I don't like Rush Limbaugh at all. I think he's a big buffoon. But despite the evidence of any, the absence of any evidence that he was linked with the bomber, and they still laid the blame at his feet. And of course, same thing happened with the JFK assassination in Dallas. That was blamed on a hostile right-wing atmosphere in Dallas, Texas, even though the assassin himself, the alleged assassin, had this deep, long history of being on the far left fringe, not on the right fringe. So, but then you look and you see when the shoe's on the other foot. Look at the Unabomber with his much marked up copy of that stupid environmentalist book by Al Gore. Well, the media, what did they, you know, reported it, but then they heard no evil, saw no evil, and spoke no evil. Very typical. And if people in the media can't decide whether they are in the business of reporting news or are making propaganda, then it's super important for us to realize that and have a discerning eye when we get news reports about these people, and not automatically repeat the mantra that, yes, we need gun control. Oh, how horrible guns are. Oh, gosh, this must be something that is really, really terrible, and shows that guns are evil. Well, I can tell you, it's not the guns that are evil. It's the people carrying the guns that are evil, or more likely, the people behind the scenes directing the people carrying the guns. Again, when I grew up in Texas, there were no problems like this, and even 10-year-old kids, of course, under supervision, but we had guns. 10-year-old boys and girls even had guns under supervision. And boy, was it a safe neighborhood, by the way. We used to go out and play at dark, and after dark, if we wanted to, out on the streets. And the biggest danger was a loose dog might bite you, or you needed to stay out of the streets if a car came by. And that was it. So do we have any questions at this point? Because this has been kind of a long rant, because I'm so irritated. I'm so annoyed. Annoying. Isn't that, even the word annoying is annoying. This is also annoying. Yeah, the word annoying is annoying. But if any of you have any questions, the main thing we see now in the U.S. at least is a push for more gun-free zones, a push to get the TSA, you know, the security service at the airports in America, to get them in public places now, and to get the UN treaty passed and the like. So this is, it's just insane. But what is really the most insane is that so many people are falling for it hook, line, and sinker, and they are trying to institute gun control laws in the U.S. And at the very least, their fallback position is, well, if we can't get tougher gun control laws, then we're going to put more security at the bus stations, at the train stations, and in major shopping malls. So this is something that is, shall I say again, the annoying word, annoying and alarming, maybe more importantly, alarming. So, okay, we don't have anyone with questions. You all probably know this better than I do, but it will be interesting to see what happens in the future on this thing and see what results from it. And I would say that if you do, write me. You have my email address, scott@monaco.mc. Write me if you have some other news on this that you think I should know about, because I'm collecting material. And then I asked Scott, do you think all people should have firearms? Well, obviously there are some people who are mentally unstable and they should not have firearms, but then they shouldn't have kitchen knives either. In fact, they probably shouldn't even be running with scissors. So I would say there are always a percentage of the population that shouldn't have anything, whether it be chewing gum, whether it should be driving an automobile, driving a motorcycle, riding a motorcycle, whether it should be flying an airplane, or even trained in martial arts. So I would say that anyone who's not demonstrably, can I say that word, proven to be mentally unfit should have the right to carry arms. Now, obviously, children should only do it, or teenagers should only do it with supervision, but that's me. And then Switzerland, yeah, a place where every household is armed. In fact, by law, every able-bodied man in Switzerland who's a citizen is required to have a gun, a semi-automatic, I think actually an automatic, rifle in his house. And that's one reason the Nazis, the German army, didn't invade Switzerland in the Second World War, because they knew every man was well armed, and the generals themselves were afraid they'd get picked off by these crack trained reservists in Switzerland. I mean, it's just incredible what a well armed country could do to scare the bejesus out of the tyrants. And how do I address the issues of apathy? Well, that is an excellent question too. And I don't know that there's a quick and ready answer to it. There will always be an apathetic minority, perhaps even an apathetic majority. But it's sort of like what Margaret Mead said, you know, the world has really changed, not by a majority, but by a very proactive minority. And someone else even refined it down to more detail when he said that really it's 10% or less of the population who really make the changes in history. And so so this is something that that is something for all of us to think about. And I know where a lot of you live, you cannot have arms without having them registered. And even then, maybe you cannot. But you might want to look into it. You might want to look into it, because if things really go pear-shaped in the next several years, you may be happy you have that gun. Obviously, if you have young children in the household, you don't want them around. You don't want the guns to be around. And that is something to be very, very careful of. And I would counsel you on that. And one of the things my father taught me at an early age was just that, and to be extremely careful. I was brought up in a household that was very respectful of guns and the danger they pose, as well as the benefits. So in any event, if anyone wants to call in and say something about this, yes, then they are welcome to, and I'd be, you know, happy to talk to them. So or answer questions. I obviously come to this subject with a very American perspective, in fact, with a very Southern American perspective, which is very, very different. But, you know, every male in my family, going back to the American Revolution and probably beyond, fought in a war. I'm the first male in my family who didn't have to. I was almost drafted for Vietnam, but then Nixon started pulling troops out of Vietnam, and the year I was supposed to be called up, they decided to stop. I had like number 132 in the lottery. And by May of that year, they called everyone up to 100. And so I was sure I was going to go, but it didn't happen. So I'm an exception. I haven't served in the military, but I have studied it a lot. I've studied military history a lot. And I learned a lot from my father, who landed on the beaches of Normandy and fought his way in the American army during World War II through France, through Germany, and into Czechoslovakia, and ended up there for 6 weeks after the war was over. So, and my grandfather's, my maternal grandfather flew for the Royal Flying Corps, which then became the Royal Air Force, in the First World War, and my other grandfather flew for the American Expeditionary Force in France. So that's kind of my military background. And then I see some people are giving us advice on how to defeat body armor and the like. And here's a question: how do you stop people having guns, and how do you decide who can have them? Really, that's always the ultimate question, but it's true for almost anything. You can apply it across the board. I mean, guns are special in a way, but they are not overly special. How do you decide who drives a car? Well, frankly, I don't believe in driver's licenses, and I don't believe in licensing gun use either. I believe that someone's going to call in a minute. I believe that you have the right to do whatever you should be able to do or can do until it's demonstrated that you can't do it. For instance, you aren't guilty of robbing a bank because you have some bolt cutters on you. But if you're caught on the way to the bank with those or you process, then of course that's another thing. Okay, there's someone on the line. Shaziz man, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you great. How are you?
Pretty good. I was listening to your show there, and I wanted to put a little thought in somebody's mind from an ex-police officer's perspective.
Right.
Well,
please go ahead.
I live way out in the country. And
in what country?
In the United States.
Okay.
And the next largest jurisdiction is at the very least 5 miles away. Okay. And so with that said, if I'm unprepared to protect myself and I have to make a 911 call, you have to factor in all the time for response as far as me getting on the phone, me calling them, them dispatching somebody and getting here. Now, in the first town that's closest to me, they only have a limited amount of officers, so that officer could be already out on another call at any given time. And so unless it's a real major emergency, they may hold your call back, and then it'll be in line waiting for, you know, depending on how important the call is. You understand what I'm saying so far?
Yes, yes. Go ahead.
Anyway, I also worked in some small towns not far from me that the actual travel time for, let's say, a sheriff's deputy to make it to the scene where I'm at, if I was to get in trouble, I'm essentially on my own for at least anywhere from 20 to 45 minutes. It could be even longer depending on where the next available deputy would be. And so me living out in the country like I am, I'm already aware of the fact that whenever I call them, the chances of them getting here in any short period of time, unless they just happen to be in the neighborhood, are slim to none. So you know as well as I do, if there's a home invasion, time is the most critical portion of this whole scene here. And
absolutely.
So,
yes.
Yeah. So if I'm not prepared to protect myself, everybody who knows me knows I'm not a violent individual, but I will defend my family to the death if need be. But, okay. I, using wisdom, know that if somebody comes in my house and they've got a firearm, a knife, a bat, or whatever, I'm trained in self-defense, so, you know, I could fend off to some extent, but I'm also not Superman either.
Right.
And so I have to have an equal force just in case that somebody comes out here, because let's say I see a bad guy out in my yard, you know, and I get on the phone. Well, how long is that bad guy going to wait before he comes into my house? And so I'm on the phone. I call the law enforcement officers, and then they have a travel time of at least, if they're coming from the first closest town, they got at least a 10 to 15 minute travel time. If they're coming from the next jurisdiction over, they got anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour travel time. So in the area that I'm at, which is about 800 square mile county, I have to hope that if a bad guy comes to my house, then there's a just by coincidence, there's a deputy nearby, like right down the street, and I get on 911. They dispatch him via the radio, and he's right there to save the day. But obviously, if you know anything about Murphy's Law, if it can go wrong, it does go wrong. So whenever you need the police, they're not there. And so I have to take this upon myself for my own safety. And one of the key things that I put a video out a while back called Time You Should Know, Part 1 and 2. But one of the things that they taught us in the police academy was that you are not there to essentially protect the individual. You're there to enforce the laws. There's a difference, you know. Of course, you give the oath that you're there to serve and protect and uphold the United States Constitution. However, they make it plain that you're not there to protect anybody. You're there to uphold the law. The protection rests on the individual person themselves. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. So how do you feel about this issue with this Mr. Holmes and the Colorado shooting and it being a possible false flag operation?
Well, unfortunately, I come from that particular seen from a police officer's point of view, and had I'd have been on the scene and seen all the things that were occurring and talked to the witnesses and the lack of their distraughtness. Let's just take a witness, for example. All right. When you're trained in the academy to watch out for all these different signs, you're there to notice things. You're there to pay attention to detail, little things such as body motions, the way that they're acting. These witnesses were supposedly in this terrible situation, but yet the tone in their voice was calm, and it wasn't to the point where, like, if I witnessed a child being shot, you could ask me a week or two later, and I would still be, you know, emotionally distraught from this situation. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So do you think some of the witnesses who saw another person in the audience go up and open the door and let Mr. Holmes in, do you think they were telling the truth or not?
Well, it's kind of hard to say, because, see, I can't confirm nor deny anything that ever even happened there, because I wasn't actually on the scene. So I can't come from it as a valid witness. Somebody's trying to call me on my phone.
I wondered what that noise was.
Yeah, I can't come at it as a valid witness, because I wasn't actually there on the crime scene. I didn't see any of that kind of stuff. I'm just coming from it from a point of view as to where the way that it was portrayed, that's probably going to be the key word, the way that the media portrayed it to me, and the indiscrepancies throughout what I know that the actual police department would have done in such a situation. Oh, they're not going to give up. Can I pause for a second?
Yeah, well, put the phone away or hang up and come back later.
Yeah, oh. I got it. I turned the volume down. Oh, they're driving me insane. Sorry about that.
That's a clever way to handle it. Okay. All right. So what's your point finally, and then we'll move on. What's your point on this call, other than you're well armed and no one better mess with you? And but no, really, I don't mean it in a bad way. And because I appreciate your calling in. But in terms of this guy, Holmes, what's your opinion on him? Was he the lone gunman? I know you weren't there. I wasn't either. But
I don't believe so. I like I said, I can't confirm nor deny that this scene ever even existed or ever even happened, for the simple fact is I paid attention to all the details that were portrayed to me, and they don't match up. I mean, a college student with, you know, no job and all the kind of stuff like you were mentioning earlier, and suddenly he's able to have police or military-grade tear gas containers, and that particular style of handgun that they said he had, which was a 40 caliber Glock, is a standard-issue police weapon. And so how does somebody who doesn't have a job or is going through college, and everybody knows that college in the United States is expensive, and you used to have to work like several jobs and try to just to keep your tuition up and all that. How does he afford all this without no red flags?
Yeah, thank you. I completely agree with you. I think this is absolutely insane. And where did it all come from? Was he just really thrifty at the supermarket, so he saved all this money over 10 years? And then finally decided to put it to this kind of use? No, I wouldn't believe that in a New York second. So
there is one other thing to factor in as well.
Sure.
Okay, if a man's that crazy that he's going to go into a theater and literally take the lives of as many people as he could possibly take out, then he's not going to have any kind of issues about doing battle with whoever comes through that door, police officer, regardless of anything, and then to turn around and tell the police officers that there's explosives in his apartment. A man who's mentally unstable and is willing to take the lives of all these people is not going to be forthcoming with all that type of information, because why would he care that the police were going to get blowed up if they went to his house he already knows that from what he's already done that the deed is going to get him either a death penalty or life in prison. It's kind of like, why would I go out and steal a Ferrari? Or why would I still go out and steal a little Volkswagen if I could go out and steal a Ferrari and get the same same amount of penalty? You understand what I'm coming from there?
I sure do.
It just doesn't add up. Don't make no sense.
No, it doesn't at all. Well, you know, I wish there were more Americans like you and we wouldn't have these problems in the first place. Just imagine if there had been some armed people in that cinema who could have taken him out, as happened on other similar types of occasions, not the exact same thing, of course. So in any event, it's just a shame no one was armed to fire back at this.
Well, and that's kind of odd. That's kind of odd as well, because, you know, they have the concealed carry, and the fact that in this entire theater, nobody had a concealed carry permit.
And then, you know why, Shaziz? You know why that is? Is because Aurora, the city of Aurora, in its infinite wisdom, has had the right and took the right to opt out of the concealed carry. So even if it's even if it were legal, which it was and is in Colorado, to have a concealed weapon if you have the permit, it wasn't in the city of Aurora.
Okay, so we can scratch that, but there's one thing that I haven't heard mentioned that we cannot scratch. Yeah. Being a police officer, I know the standard procedure. The moment they even got wind of somebody running out of that theater or any kind of sounds that even remotely sounded like gunshot, standard procedure is to surround that doggone building to where whoever's coming out, going in, you understand what I'm saying? I mean, it would have been an immediate response.
Well, you know what? I really appreciate your viewpoint on this, because you come from a perspective that I cannot. You've had police training. You can look at it with law enforcement eyes that I don't have. And so I very much appreciate it. I am going to want to ask you to hang up now, only because we have some other people calling in. And I think having you on the line is blocking the other people's attempts to get on air as well, if you don't mind.
Oh, no, that's fine. I appreciate your time there. I just want to put a couple points out there.
Oh, I'm so glad you did. It added to the show, and I super appreciate it. And, hey, you're my kind of guy out there. So if I'm not going to ask on the air what neighborhood you're in, but if I knew and I were there, I'd know where the safe place was to go. It wouldn't be a gun-free zone, that's for sure.
Well, like I tell everybody on my show, if the apocalypse ever occurs, come to the house with the lights on, because that's where Shaziz lives.
Oh, that's good. Okay, and thank you for telling me how to pronounce your name, too. Shaziz, okay.
Yeah,
well, thank you, Shaziz, so much for calling in. I very much appreciate it. And good luck to you. And I think they're going to try to get this other caller on as soon as you're off, and we'll see who that is. Okay?
Take care. Peace and love, everybody.
Thank you, Shaziz. Bye. Okay. Well, he obviously knew a lot of things I didn't know about law enforcement and that perspective, and I really appreciate him having called in. And I think Vincent is trying to get Sar on the line, because Sar was holding or trying to get in, and with this system it wasn't working as long as we had someone else on the line. But okay.
Sorry, Scott. Vin here. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Yeah, just I don't know what Sar is doing, but Sar, who's trying to call in now, VINCENTTEMP and the digit 1. There's no spaces and it's all lowercase. And if you could PM me on the site your Skype name, I'll add you into the conversation that way.
That's a great idea. And remember, Sar, there are two T's in Vincent Temp, double T. And meanwhile, while we're waiting for Sar, I have run over. They said it's okay. Actually, I just really wanted to talk about how ludicrous these gun-free zones are. For example, the cinema where this shooting happened, that cinema has a policy that only law enforcement officers may carry weapons into their theaters. So, of course, it does nothing but guarantee that the massacre would be successful. And probably the killer was well aware of this policy and knew that the theater would be ideal for his purposes. So here's a case where it just definitely played into his hands and really ended up hurting a lot of people. And many instances where someone, I mean, just look at the Virginia Tech shooting. Had any of those students been armed, they could have taken that guy out or at least slowed him down greatly and saved, you know, a dozen or more lives. So at least, or people from being injured, wounded. So it does actually pay. And one thing that I notice in the media is they're very quick to tell you when someone gets killed by a gun, but they do not tell you the hundredfold, really literally the thousandfold more times where an injury or a death or a harm was thwarted, was prevented by the presence of a gun. And I see that a lot because I monitor those things. You can see those where just the mere brandishing of a gun scares someone off. I had that with a very good friend of mine in San Antonio, Texas, one year. He was walking from his business at night, which was a jewelry store, and he heard, didn't see, but heard two guys behind him. All he did was draw his gun and hold it where they could see it. And he heard, oh, he's got a gun. And then they scurried away. That's all he had to do. He never even turned around to face them. And he was carrying tens of thousands of dollars of jewelry on him as he left that store. That was a very good friend of mine. And I heard it directly from him. This isn't a third-hand story. And it probably certainly saved him from a beating, probably saved his life. And he didn't have to exert any calorie loss other than whatever calories he burned by pulling the gun from his holster and holding it out. That was it. So in any event, let's see if we have anyone asking any questions online. Looks like Sar has some Skype connection issues. That's too bad. I bet he had something good to say. And so that is, okay. When I talked about the booby-trapped room, someone said it's probably Bobby-trapped. Yeah, okay. It probably was. All right. That's a nice one.
Sorry, Scott, Vin here. I think we have Sar should be on the line there now.
Oh, great. Okay. So here's our guy. Hi, Sar. Welcome on air.
Oh, Roger. Thank you. Did I monitor correctly? Well, first of all, is my sound level 5x5? Is this good? Mic too close, too far?
It might be 6x6, but I'd say it's really good. That was a bad joke. You're coming across very clearly, Sar. Thank you.
Your Saturday Night Light funny, your funny buddy, I'm laughing.
Hey, it's a tough crowd out there. It's a tough crowd.
You are funny. You are Tactical Operations Center funny.
Yeah, I wish I would be able to quit my day job, but
nah, no, you pick up a guy, you talk back 2577s back up into each other and pull some maps out. You are Battalion Command funny, buddy.
Okay, well, thank you, Sar. So, what? And I know you've said some good things, excellent things, in fact, on the chat line. What can you share with us tonight?
Did I monitor correctly that you stated that you are a direct bloodline descendant of a warrior?
Well, yes, I am, but that is true.
Of the American War for Independence.
Yes, that is true too.
Amen.
Yeah, we were busy fighting the oppressors then, which actually by today's standards, we should have had over for a cup of tea. But by today's standards, they were lightweights and were probably, very congenial people. But you look at the thieves and cutthroats in Washington, D.C. these days, and we wonder what we traded it all for, don't we?
No, not at all. They nipped it in the bud. They nipped it in the bud.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, go ahead.
You have a contract law relationship with the U.S. government, or you are sovereign. May I ask, are you the sovereign posterity of the preamble, we the people of the U.S. Constitution, or are you voluntary political chattel?
Well, you know what's so funny, and I'm going to answer your question with a long statement. So let's see, what is it, 2012? So about 20, maybe 21 years ago, I got interested in, or someone made me aware of, or whatever, in the sovereign citizen movement in California at that time where I was living. And I read up on a lot of that. In fact, I was one of the foremost readers on the subject, and I know about the contract law, admiralty law, whether your names are in all caps or not, and all of that. And with all due respect, Sar, I'm not a big buyer of it because I saw too many people at that time in the early 90s have the IRS and the federal government cut through their common law trusts and their sovereign citizen claims like a knife, a hot knife through warm butter, cut through all of them and seize their assets and throw them in jail and do all sorts of horrible things to them, even if they, as they were screaming at the top of their lungs that they were sovereign citizens. I mean, I saw it. One of them was even a state senator named Don Rogers, who was a friend of mine, Senator Don Rogers. They took his cars, his airplanes, his boats. He had them all locked up solid in common law trusts, and he, I don't know how much he solidly followed the sovereign citizen movement, but I am aware of all of that, but I've gone away from it because and I don't mean to rain on anyone's parade because God bless them. I hope it works for those people who aren't high profile, but I've never seen it really work for a high profile person. I mean, even look at Wesley Snipes. He got thrown in prison, and he was doing the sovereign citizen thing, although I don't think he was doing it the right way, to be fair to sovereign citizens. But I do believe in it. I believe you're right. But in the practical world, I've seen it cut down right and left whenever they want to. They just ignore it, just like they're ignoring the Constitution now. Just like they're ignoring it with Obamacare, with all these laws against our personal freedoms and everything. They don't care. They just go through it and it means nothing to them. They're just words. Whether you're in a courtroom with a flag with a gold fringe or not, they're going to get you if they want to get you. And that's what they do. And they'll either do something bad to you, physically, or they'll do something to your assets or whatever. I know that sounds rather dark and dreary, but the best thing we can do is shine light on subjects like we're doing here and to try to do that. So having said all that, you've been so polite. You've been quiet while I did my little rant, but it's really your turn to talk, and maybe there's something I'm missing there. What am I missing?
Good sir, I agree with your tactical and strategic assessment 110%. The issue that I'm addressing is totally different, however.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, let me get your issue so I can answer the right question then. Sorry.
I do not know when your forebear served on the battlefield.
Oh.
In my case.
Uh-huh.
Captain Michael Holderbaum was popularly elected by his sovereign peers in 1775 to the position of commander, 5th Company, 1st Battalion, Greenewalt's Battalion. Greenewalt being tasked with Army Commissary General George Washington's personal headquarters staff, 1778. Now,
well, my hat is off to you. Let me just interject. My hat is off to you. That's one, you know which ancestor exactly, and two, you recited that so superbly and confidently. I admire you for it. So anyway, please go ahead.
We have to know where we come from and where we are in order to plan where we are going. For example, I am Hall of Knights, Taunus, Festung Kranzberg, U.S. Army Usarjur, 3rd Armored Division, Spearhead.
Now, okay.
What I want to share with you is the following.
Mm-hmm.
A contract law relationship between we the people was established subsequent to 1775. Department of Army 1775 established precedent over political chattel in Washington, D.C. and the Union. We the People Declaration of Independence occurs on the anniversary of the slaughter of European ultramarine royalty at Horns of Hattin by Salah al-Din on 4 July.
Mm-hmm.
And hence, the Declaration of We the People Independence in the United States occurs 1776. I submit that we the people retain the right to change our government peacefully.
Absolutely. I agree.
At any time we choose, so long as we have a direct bloodline to a warrior who secured our rights for his posterity by force of arms on the battlefield. Now, for warriors that were Johnny Come Lately, 77, 82, the issue may be more obscure in Kangaroo Court for cornering if they cross the bar. For those who immigrated subsequent to 1775, they may not have a snowball's chance in Hades. For first-generation immigrant political chattel or invader like Soy Toro Obama, what's-his-face from Africa, they operate under an entirely different political venue. All that I am asking you is, do you know when your grandpa locked and loaded in the U.S.?
Well, you said grandpa, but I assume you mean great, great, great grandpa.
Yeah, you're way back. He's my 11th grandpa.
Yeah. So I have the name somewhere. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it's in a logbook that has all of those. I just know that he did, or even they did, fight in the American Revolutionary War, and the Knight ancestors who fought in the Second War of Independence, which is also called the American Civil War, and then subsequently. But I don't know that. But let me ask you a question, if I can, Sar, and that is, where did you get the idea? And I'm not saying it's incorrect or correct. I'm just asking for my own information. Where did you get the idea that it has to be someone who bore arms as of that date? I mean, you know, there are other ways to become citizen of the country. And I don't think just having borne arms on that date would be the only criteria for being able to set aside the social contract, unless you're saying that the connection is that they obviously created the contract. But then in saying that, you're also presuming, I don't mean you, but you know, whomever's proposing that line of thought, they're presuming that that goes down to your heirs. But I'm not a believer that contract rights necessarily go down the line of heirs. But I do agree with you that we can change the peacefully, of course, change the form of government that we're in if we so desire, if enough people so desire. But if I make a contract with, say, you, that doesn't mean I don't have a son or a daughter, but if I were to have had one, that doesn't mean that they would be bound by that contract unless they themselves sign that contract as well. So I'm just wondering how it makes it down the chain of generations from the warrior, revolutionary warrior. I mean, it's a romantic idea. I like it, but how does the contract survive through subsequent generations?
A SAR can be of great assistance to you. Sons of the American Revolution, they have a great ancient 201 file of warriors who served, and I strongly encourage you to contact SAR or research their assets online. If you have your forebear's name, you should be able to access surviving service records, although they're spotty. If he was anywhere, anytime, you'll find him. And also, DAR will help you, Daughters of the American Revolution. So you need to contact SAR and DAR. Then the second question you ask, I may respond by saying defeat in the battlefield does not mean that those who were defeated and retrograde to secondary and tertiary were wrong. And Bunker Hill, New York Island, Germantown, and Brandywine bear this out, Yorktown. Three, the letter of the Declaration of Independent states that we secure for ourselves and our posterity. This has the meaning and substance of naturally born posterity. Hence, I know I am the bloodline natural born posterity for whom those rights in declaration was secured by force of combat arms. Now, they could have been unsuccessful, but they weren't. I could get into a lot of reasons in Genesis chapter 48 why they were successful, but that's not germane. The final answer to your question regarding venue. Yes, yes, by all means, good sir. Why should genealogy and bloodline be like a stinking freaking royal? Why do these warriors think they're special? By all means, political chattel should avail themselves and say, I am the sovereign posterity of we the people. I was naturally born in the Union of the United States of America, and I peacefully terminate all contract law relationship with political chattel governance. And while I may no longer participate in your system, sir, you must represent me. You may not infringe my inalienable or unalienable rights endowed by the Creator God, nor may you do personal injury or property damage. Now, I say by all means, people should explore those venues. My only question was, it's a no-brainer, buddy. If you're a combat warrior descendant, you have birthright, and that's a letter of the Declaration. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, Sar, very much. And actually, you've given a new spin to something that
not spin, buddy. It's the truth.
No, I don't mean it.
Please,
put your hand over that blood vessel. I don't like it throbbing. I didn't mean to insult you. It's just my phrase for that. It's not a spin in a negative way. It's just a new, let me say, twist. I'll use the word twist. It's sort of like the English say scheme. You know, this scheme, and Americans hear that word and they think, oh my God, it's like a scam. Because to Americans, scheme means scam. But to the British, scheme is something like more akin to project. So it's just one of those things. So I meant it more like a twist. This is a new or angle even. You've given a new angle to something that I hadn't heard even way back when, because I'd never heard it. So I certainly would look into it. And as much as I respect the Declaration of Independence and I love the words, I still hold to my own philosophical belief that I cannot bind my own children or other children to a social contract that I myself have made. I can bind myself. I have the right to bind myself or anyone else who's voluntarily signed on to it, but I don't have the right to bind anyone other than myself, and that's my principle of contract law. But
oh my God, man, you may not bind your children to life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness, buddy.
Hey,
That's Saturday Night Live funny, Abbott.
Yeah, well, you make it sound like it's funny, and in some respects, it is. I wish I could bind them to that. But the flip side of the coin is, if I'm able to bind them to life, liberty, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness, would I not be able to bind them to slavery as well? And I don't like the flip
side. But they may peacefully change that governance, sir.
Well, then they can do the same with or without my social contract. So
we have the lawful, peaceful opportunity, and we should not disregard this venue, because we must live at peace with all men as long as possible, because combat and war is a fecal, urine, stinky, funky clothes, blood and nastiness, and it's sadness and tears. Peaceful venue.
Yeah. Well,
killed anybody? Have you ever been in hand-to-hand combat, made a kill, buddy?
Well, I hurt someone's feelings once.
Okay, you killed their spirit, huh? Me too. You gotta report that kind of stuff. We got to seek peaceful resolution. The word of God, and this is my conviction, it states that a remnant will survive. Now, they're going to control all buying and selling, but they ain't going to control all bartering and trading. We got options. That's all I'm trying to say. Peaceful ones. Now, I severed all contract law relationship based on the descendant issue I've already elaborated. Man, we got buku solutions and options here, man. We could go after these other venues you spoke of, because I agree with you 110%. Free men and those sovereign citizens, they had their clock cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
You got to try something new.
Well, you know what, Sar? I really appreciate it. And I actually have enjoyed you on the chat line more than I could even say, because you always come up with very cogent and good thoughts and all of that. Let me just ask a quick question. You don't have to answer. And then we should probably yield the floor to Mr. C, because everyone's hammering for Mr. C. But what part of the – can you tell me what part of the U.S. you're in?
Tucson, Arizona, 85705. I'll have birthright in Tennessee River Valley.
I see. Yeah, I had ancestors that came from Tennessee, and I know Pima County, the FBI.
Buddy, free and clear. Everybody, get some land here, free and clear, a place where you can be.
Yep, Pima County. Well, anyway, I enjoyed it, and I enjoy you being on the chat line too. And we should probably yield, because I am taking Mr. C's time, and he's been more than generous on other shows, but I probably shouldn't.
Hey, hang up, buddy.
All right, so let's go back to Vince. I think Vince is on the line, and we thank you, Sar, and I hope to hear from you again from Pima County, beautiful Pima County that I've driven through many a time. And so there we have it. Sar, thank you, Geronimo. And Vincent, I will yield, and now to Mr. C, whom everyone has been waiting patiently for.
Actually, it'll be E.T. tonight, Scott. Mr. C is actually traveling around Ireland at the moment, so he's on his holidays at the moment, yeah. So he won't be on tonight. He put a message in the host room. Granada Steve put a message in the host room rather earlier on saying he was still otherwise occupied at the moment. So,
okay, well, thank you. And I will then sign off. I'll see or hear or both everybody next Wednesday at this 9 o'clock time. And I don't think we'll go over then. We'll have a guest then. I don't know whom yet. Send your suggestions in if you have any, and we'll go from there. Thank you, everyone. Talk to you later. Bye.
And that was Scott Tips, folks. And tune in again next week for Scott on tnsradio.com. Time check for you, just approaching 9:30. I'm going to hand over now to well, I'm going to hand over to E.T. if you can take more E.T. Here we go.